Welcome to Stoma and Continence Conversations from Coloplast Professional. I'm Paul.
And I'm Karen. We know stoma and bowel and bladder issues impact the lives of those that you care for.
We're here to support your educational needs and help you in supporting your patients.
We're talking to fellow healthcare professionals and experts by experience to discuss the latest hot topics in the worlds of stoma, continence care and specialist practice.
As we come to the end of our first year doing the Coloplast Professional podcast, we wanted to share some of the best bits from the episodes with you. We've had lots of guests come and share their knowledge, and with a few laughs as well. And it's thanks to them that we have any best bits to share with you at all. The reason we started the podcast was so we could explore key educational topics that you wanted from us in greater detail. We also wanted it to be a little bit more personable than anything else we could do, such as written down and the written word. By speaking to people who have worked and still do work in specialist nursing, we want you to be able to relate to the experiences of our guests and learn from what they have to share. We know that becoming a specialist nurse isn't easy, and when you work as a nurse, your learning never stops. But when you take on a specialism, your needs change, and this is where Maddie White explains it incredibly well.
The majority of nurses now will have a first degree. Alongside the clinical learning, which, as you say, once you start in post as a specialist nurse, increases dramatically. Your learning needs are different because it is about learning how to communicate effectively, to understand those nuances of communication that make communication effective. We can say the right things to patients, and we can say the things that we have learned about their disease, about their treatment. But how we communicate that is really important. What we don't want is nurses rushing into communication thinking, I've got to get all of this knowledge out and I've got to tell them everything. And actually that might not be pertinent at that particular point in time. And that comes with experience. So I would say for any person coming into specialist nursing, it's about consolidating the information and the learning they've already done and then taking it one step further. Now that might be within the clinical arena, learning from others, senior people around them, spending time in clinics, spending time with consultants. You learn an awful lot. You also learn how not to communicate in some instances because people don't always do it effectively. But understanding what effective communication is an absolute must for me. When you're speaking to patients who've got a new diagnosis, who have got a poor prognosis, all of these issues, if you don't communicate with them effectively, then you're not going to make progress with them. Then you can look at the academic side and say, well, how can I bolster my knowledge? How can I support what I'm saying? Where's the evidence for that? And undertaking some sort of an academic qualification is really helpful, not only because you're learning about the subject itself, but also about that critical thinking. How does knowing that knowledge impact upon my practice? How do I put that into practice so that it's meaningful? So whatever I learn within that academic field by doing an assignment, which people don't like doing, but, you know, if you're going to do a master's degree or a first degree if you haven't got one, it is about applying that knowledge to the clinical situation and bridging that gap. But that exposure to that academic side gives you that ability to then critically think, not only academically, but also clinically. So all of this added together is what makes a good nurse specialist for me. And it's that willingness to undertake all of that. And that's an awful lot to take on. It's not just about being in a post where you work Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. It's more about being the best possible nurse you can be within that specialism.
Incredibly powerful words from Maddie there. I think one of the best ways to learn is through experience and the experience of others. And there's no other more experienced almost than Dr. Terry Porritt, who has worked as in specialist care for over 20 odd years now. And she's seen some big changes throughout her time.
If there's one single thing I would say, it was, and I remember the excitement when we first received a convex ring that would give us a convex pouch. So back in the day, there was a flat pouch. That was it. There was no convexity. There was certainly no concave products. And we had thick Coria seals, and we had Stomahesive and Aura-base paste, but that was it. So for a retracted stoma, we had nothing. We made Blue Peter type solutions with bits that we had. And so the excitement and the change in experience for patients when the first convex product was produced, and that wasn't an integrated convex bag as we now have, so integrated into the flange, but this was a standalone rock hard white plastic convex ring which you put inside a two-piece base plate. And this plastic was rigid. There was no pliability in it at all. It was really hard, really sharp. So once you cut out the aperture in the flange, and you would, because the adhesives were thicker, you would always rub your finger around the inside to get rid of any kind of thick little bits of adhesive if it wasn't a perfect kind of circle. You could cut your finger really deeply on the plastic convex ring. It made a huge difference because we didn't have anything until then. But did it put pressure around the stoma? Did it have any flex lines? Did it have any flexibility at all? No. So there was a really, really high risk of developing pressure necrosis around the stoma, ischemia, ulcers. It was really up because this was an absolutely rigid insert. So we developed our practice based on this is convexity. There is a really high risk of convexity. And I think many of us who were taught by stoma care nurses whose first experience of convexity was this solid ring, we're taught by our peers. So actually, they will use their experiential learning from the first time they cut their finger on this really hard plastic ring. But I think we still practice thinking that deep convexity means the risk of the development of ischemia and necrosis and ulcers around and the skin around the stoma is as high as it was when we first had convexity, because it was a really, really significant risk. We were following people up after 2 or 3 days. Come back to, we need to see you, because is the skin going, you know, blue, purple color? Are we getting already the signs of it? It was really problematic. And I think that risk is transferred to now, where actually with the development, with all the manufacturers, the literature shows us now the biggest risk of an ulcer around a stoma is from the lug of a belt pulled too tight and not from a light, soft or deep convex product. But I think that we haven't potentially become as confident using deep convexity or even soft convexity as we should have. So I believe we still in our practice tend to build up that the patient might need deep convexity, but do you know what? Just in case there's a problem, I need to show that flat with a seal and a soft convexity wasn't enough. They're still getting it to cover myself in case they do then develop a complication with deep convexity.
Nothing beats this experience, and passing it on to others is a great way of us all helping each other. That's one of the reasons I invited Ben Wakefield, one of the editors for the Mark Allen Group, about how to write for publication. During our chat, he talked about the complex issue of copyright.
The basics of UK law on copyright of photographs is the person who takes a picture owns the copyright of it. If you take your own photo, copyright-wise, that is yours. You can share it and offer it to be published elsewhere. The other issue is patient confidentiality. So things to do with healthcare, the general practice, and there are very few exceptions to this really, is everything should be anonymous. And for a great many things that might be in any sense revealing about a person, their permission should be explicitly sought and attained. And then when you do that, even with someone's permission, don't publish it under their name and don't include personally revealing information. So for example, if someone had a prominent tattoo, try not to have that in the picture, crop it out. But photos are incredibly useful for something as visual as, for example, peristomal skincare. It makes such a difference to be able to demonstrate what you're talking about with real life examples. I think they're fantastically useful and I really encourage you to do it. And taking photographs, I imagine, will be quite a big part of practice for things like skincare, especially with more remote consultations and things like that. So if you can get permission to have these things used for publication and educational materials, that can be very helpful. The other issue is reusing other people's images. In general, you can't just reuse a picture you find on Google image search or somewhere like that because someone else owns that. You either need explicit permission from the person who owns it, you need to get a Creative Commons in public domain image. So lots of pictures on Wikipedia actually are available. And I know that there are some very good pictures from, I think it's Cancer Research UK, about different interventions and operations and bowel resections and stuff like that, that are free to use. Or you can say to an editor, I want a picture like this, but one that we've got copyright for, so I can get that redrawn by an illustrator or buy an equivalent one. And there are plenty of places where pictures can be bought. We buy a lot from a place called Adobe Stock and somewhere else called Science Photo Library. Text is not copyrighted in quite the same way. And for example, if there was a chart, graph, a table, a flow chart from another source, you can reproduce that where it just gets put into a different format with different colors and squares and stuff on it. And that's out of copyright because the content itself, as long as this source is mentioned and it's referenced as from a quote, the content or the data in a graph, for example, isn't copyrighted. It's only the exact drawing of it that is copyrighted.
I genuinely had no idea about most of this, so thanks for Ben for sharing it with us. Staying with Right for Publication, one thing that I know a lot of us find scary is having our peers review the work that we've actually done. And this is what Ben had to say on that.
It's worth putting nursing publication, nursing journals into perspective and context here. So you might see, I don't know, memes about peer review, about how cutthroat and mercenary and unpleasant it is. I am sure that's true in other areas of science and perhaps some other areas of healthcare. Nursing publication is a very supportive, positive community. People are not trying to get each other rejected. So, I mean, the nightmare stories you might hear from other people working in other academic disciplines could be very true, but I don't think they apply to nursing publication at all.
Throughout all of the conversations I've had on this podcast, one thing comes through each and every time, and that's the patient comes first. And here's Natasha Rowles' take on it.
We are adverse to harm, to doing harm. Of course we are, and that's exactly what we should be. But everything we do has the potential. Even not doing anything has the potential. And in many instances in stoma care, not doing anything at all or being fearful of taking the next step will be the most harmful thing, because what we're dealing with in stoma care is the psychology of the patient as well, and feeling unsupported or feeling like there isn't a solution or feeling like they're not heard is as damaging as persistent leaks. And persistent leaks themselves are also psychologically damaging. So you know, I'm not saying we have to be all singing, all dancing every time they walk in the clinic room. But we do have to be able to demonstrate that there are options for us to take and that we're thinking about them, that we are going through processes to try and help them, to try and resolve these issues. And I think that's really powerful for me, because I think particularly now, particularly during the pandemic, but for a long time, patients, there aren't many areas that patients feel heard. It's a process. And that's why I say that I understand people's reluctance with validated tools, because you don't want them to feel it isn't a process. It isn't box ticking. It isn't simply pushing someone through. It's an adjunct to your practice. It's a support to your practice. But actually, most of what you do in a clinical environment is hear your patient, listen to them, understand them, and try and find solutions for them. And the tool is a part of that. It doesn't replace that by any shape. And it also doesn't mean that we can suddenly all be band twos. And because we can tick a box, we know how to do the, you know, clinical nurse specialists are specialists. And these tools can support our specialism, not undermine it.
I could listen to Natasha talk for hours, and luckily enough, I have been able to. And Natasha was, of course, talking about validated tools that we have at our disposal to help care for our patients. Sometimes, though, it's the patients themselves that will determine how successful their recovery is, and therefore the way in which we provide care to them. Maddie White explains this more.
It can be very challenging at times, and challenging for people. Some of it is centred around their personality. I have this theory that patients' personality will affect how they recover from their surgery. Some patients will, you know, they will have experienced traumas of some sort or another in their life before, and they will pull on those coping strategies and those previous experiences to help them through emotionally. Whereas others will, you know, they will never have had something as big as having to go through the trauma of surgery and have a stoma. And it's like a bolt out of the blue, and they find it extremely difficult to cope with emotionally. So for us as stoma care nurses, we are often faced with the unknown. I mean, particularly if patients have had surgery as an emergency, you don't know these patients. You've had no time to build up a rapport. You don't know what their reaction is going to be. So I think for us, it's about having the skills to be able to pick up those cues and those little nuances that say to you, is this patient coping with this? Are there any clues that I can pick up on that are going to make me think, no, that's a worry? You know, how are we going to help the patient to cope longer term than just, you know, getting over this surgery? So I think some of that comes with experience, but it's also about looking at body language and picking up those little cues and the things that they say, and being able to evaluate their perception of what their illness has been like, what their recovery is going to be like. And for some patients, they might think that having a cancer, for instance, I've had this surgery, but actually I've got a stoma now, and that's a trade-off. I'd rather have that than have my cancer. And from that point of view, you know, they find that it's actually a positive, and they will just strive to carry on with their life and get over their treatment. But for others, it can be a real burden to have a stoma, because it can be unexpected. I often hear patients say, oh, I never, ever thought I'd want one of these. You know, a stoma and a bag was always the worst thing I could think of to have done. Whereas actually in reality, when they've got it, they realise that it's not the be-all and end-all, and it's not the end of their life. And with support from us and from their family and other relationships that they have, then they can get through this.
I'm really pleased that we were able to start with Maddie talking about being the best nurse you possibly can. And I think this last part from Maddie was incredibly important, of how we always put the family and the patient in the centre of everything that we do. So great words from Maddie to end, I think. We'll be back soon with a brand new series of Stoma and Continence Conversations. If there's a particular subject you'd like us to take on and talk about, please get in touch. Send me an email. The address, along with a link to the Coloplast Professional website, is in the show notes. I'd love to hear from you about how you're finding the podcast and your ideas for topics for future episodes too. That leaves me just to say thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back with you soon for a brand new series. Stoma and Continence Conversations is brought to you by Coloplast Professional. To learn more, visit coloplastprofessional.co.uk.